famous. They'd be interviewed on TV. They'd be in the Chicago Tribune. Groping his way along, he found a chair and sat down slowly. He'd better stop daydreaming. A number of things had to happen before the painting was safe, if it was the painting. To occupy himself, he worked on some puzzles in his head. First, he made 3 different 12-piecers. Then, he tried writing to Tommy, but without the code, it was tough. Soon, Calder felt himself wanting to doze. It was so quiet and so dark. Petra hurried down to the lower school office at lunchtime.
Mrs. Trek isn't here, dear. She's gone for the rest of the day.
The secretary looked irritated. Petra felt a rush of determination.
The basement. My friend Calder and I need to finish an assignment by today. Is there someone who could let me in?
We don't allow kids down there alone, you know that.
Mrs. Trek said it was fine for us to finish our research, though,
Petra lied.
She said she'd make an exception. Please, plus, we're 6th graders.
The secretary looked at Petra and sighed.
All right, just let me get my lunch.
While the secretary was gone, Petra looked carefully at the top of her desk. Maybe the keys were inside the drawer. If she found them, should she race down and let Calder out? If the secretary came with her, she'd discover Calder had been there all morning. It'd be better to get blamed for taking the keys. She stepped quickly over to the desk, jerked open the drawer, and found, sure enough, the fat ring of master keys. Stuffing them into her pants pocket, she headed toward the basement entrance as fast as she could go without looking conspicuous. She waited outside the basement door, pretending to use the payphone, until there was no one in either direction. Her hands were fumbly and damp. First one key, no. Then another, no. Someone was coming. Petra picked up the phone again, her heart pounding wildly. She felt sure the person walking by would hear it, but they didn't stop. The third key turned easily. Pulling open the basement door, she clicked on the switch and slipped inside.
Calder! Calder!
She whispered at the foot of the stairs. There was no answer. It was too quiet. Couldn't he hear her? As her eyes adjusted to the dark, she made out a small figure slumped in a chair. The package was still held tightly in his arms. Her first thought was that he died of fright. She hurried over and gave him a prod. He popped upright.
Jeesh, Petra, I ought to get 10 pounds of blue ones for being down here all this time.
I'm glad you're all right, but hurry up, Calder. I had to steal the keys. Hurry!
They were up the stairs, peeking out the door, and in the front hall in seconds. They clicked the basement door shut behind them. Petra grabbed a jacket from the lost and found box in the lobby and covered the package with it just as the secretary came around the corner carrying her lunch.
Well, hello, you two. I'll be right back to let you in. It won't take long, will it?
Silent, both shook their heads. As soon as she headed off toward the office, Petra looked at Calder in a panic.
Now what? What do we do about her keys?
Leave them in the door to the basement. She'll think Mrs. Trek left them there.
Petra and Calder were too nervous to talk on the walk home from school. They raced up Calder's front steps and straight to his room. Both struggled with the zipper on Calder's backpack. In the rush at school, he had pulled it closed on the fabric.
Stupid thing.
Calder grabbed scissors from his desk and cut open the backpack. They pulled off the tape wrapped around and around the brown paper. The edges of a dark wooden frame emerged, and then an old backing. They turned it over. Someone with an eager, pear-shaped head and a green bun sat writing at a table. Her one visible ear was graced with what looked like a dangling ping-pong ball. There was an orange moon behind her and a melting castle. The painting might have been done by a second grader who was now a grandparent. It was not the lady they'd been looking for. Chapter 17. What happens now? Calder was home with a cold the following day, and Petra walked home from school by herself. It was early December, and patches of ice alternated with drifts of brown leaves. Petra scuffed along, thinking about Charles Fort. He wouldn't be feeling discouraged. He'd have his eyes wide open. With that in mind, she picked up a scrap of graph paper off the ground and read, corn oil, butter, tea bags, onions, green grapes, bacon. She popped it into her pocket. Was there poetry here, in these accidental combinations of words? Would Fort have seen an interesting pattern or a secret of the universe in grocery lists? Hey, this might be something they could get into with Miss Hussey one day. Accidental combinations of sounds and ideas. Why did some words seem more elegant, more graceful than others? Why were some words peanut butter and jelly sounds, and others caviar? What made the words onion or tea bag so plain? Why did a word like ice or exquisite sound so lacy? Inspired by the idea, Petra spotted another piece of paper. It was tucked into a thorny hedge near Mrs. Sharp's house and torn along the bottom. Folded in four, it looked worn. She opened it carefully and began to read. Dear friend, I would like your help in identifying a crime that is now centuries old. Petra ran straight over to Calder's house. Did anyone see you pick it up? I looked around. Only one person crossing the street. Calder blew his nose vigorously. Do you think it's the same letter you started to read, the one that blew away? How could it be? Maybe there's a fourth letter. Petra groaned. Calder reached for his pentominoes. It's creepy to think of someone sticking that letter carefully in Mrs. Sharp's bushes. Do we tell the police? It'll make it harder for us to keep looking. Good thinking. But neither one of us should walk around here on our own. We could end up like that frog kid. They refolded the letter, placed it neatly inside a sandwich bag, and tucked it into the geographer's box. They each ate a blue one. Then they each ate two more. Calder was holding the pea pentomino. P for prey, he said, trying to grin. Petra looked horrified. Prey, she said. Us? You mean we're being hunted? No, I meant prey, as in hoping to stay safe, Calder said. Maybe it's prey, we're not prey, Petra added, scaring them both. The next day, more news broke. A book appeared in the stores that morning called The Vermeer Dilemma, What Happens Now? Easily a $50 art book, it was being sold for an unusually affordable $1.50. This was less than the price of a Big Mac. An anonymous gift had made it possible for everyone with an interest in Vermeer and in this painful situation to buy the book. Written by a respected art historian, it included an excellent color plate of every painting attributed to Vermeer. Thousands of copies changed hands across the United States on the first day, and countries around the world reported similar sales. The book was about all the positive things that had come out of this terrible crime. People were looking at and talking about paintings as they never had before. They were comparing furniture, tile work, the structure of a leaded glass window, the folds in a satin skirt. They were comparing details, like the way light struck a fingernail or a wrist bone, the look of a woven basket handle or a curl of hair. They were examining works of art with a toughness and intensity, usually seen only in the buyers of new cars or electronics. Groups of people pointing and arguing energetically in front of a Vermeer had become a common sight. Museums were busier and livelier places. It was the first time that many untrained people had felt that they could say something of value about a work of art, something that might make a difference. It was the first time that many people had realized how murky and changeable the waters of history can be. When an artist leaves behind no personal papers, when hundreds of years go by, who is to say that followers or forgers didn't use his or her name to make some money? And, of course, the idea of correcting a centuries-old mistake, of pointing out that the experts in museums and universities weren't really as expert as they'd thought they were, was irresistible. Children were thinking about Vermeer, too. They were comparing, writing, and visiting museums with friends. Many said that they hadn't realized how cool old pictures could be. They also hadn't realized that the art in museums can be mysterious, that grown-ups don't always know what it means or where it came from. The author talked about how this uproar was probably also good for art historians and museum curators. It was forcing them to question views that had been accepted for decades, to look carefully at what they had been taught. Was the thief right? Was the public right? Why didn't the so-called early and late Vermeers have that luminous, haunting touch? The book ended by stating firmly that while what the thief had done to get the attention of the art world was wrong, the public's relationship to Vermeer and to other great masters had, as a result, changed drastically. People around the world had developed a comfort with great art that they never had before. The theft was a gift. The last page carried a message to the thief. Whether or not museums chose to change the wall labels next to some of Vermeer's paintings, the public had done an amazing job of spotlighting any possible fraud. Everyone was now looking. It was only a matter of time, the author suggested, before museums would respond to the public's thinking. In the meantime, a lady writing should be returned. The thief could consider his mission to have been successful. Chapter 18, A Bad Fall. Petra and Calder talked about the book on the way to school the next morning.
All these questions being asked by people around the world, Petra said, still excited by what she'd read. It does make the theft seem partly good.
Yeah, but what if the thief turns out not to be as moral as he sounds? What if he's a real sicko?
Someone on the radio was talking about that this morning.
Petra looked sideways at Calder.
But don't you think I would sort of know if the lady had been hurt?
They walked several steps in silence. Calder kicked at a snowbank.
Maybe, and maybe not. I wish she'd say something else to you, like, down this street, up those steps, in this cupboard, and presto.
They were laughing when they turned the corner near Mrs. Sharp's house. To their horror, they found themselves facing the flashing lights of an ambulance. The children stood, mouths open, as a stretcher appeared at Mrs. Sharp's door. The old woman was neatly strapped in under a mound of blankets. She looked tiny and pale. Two policemen followed the emergency technicians.
Mrs. Sharp, are you okay?
Blurted Petra. Calder called out,
What happened?
At the sound of their voices, the old woman turned her head.
Oh, good. It's you two. Close your mouths before your tongues freeze.
Mrs. Sharp struggled to get her hand out from under the blankets.
Stop, you carriers. I want to speak with the children. I know them.
Mrs. Sharp's imperious tone brought everyone to a standstill.
I slipped and cracked something in one leg. Very stupid of me, I must say. Never broken anything in my life. I was planning to take this letter to the post office today. I could have someone in the hospital mail it, but I would prefer giving it to the two of you.
No problem.
Calder reached for the letter in Mrs. Sharp's hand. She watched with something of her old fierceness while Calder put away the letter.
Now don't forget and don't lose it, boy.
Mrs. Sharp was eyeing the duct tape on Calder's backpack.
The two of you can visit me at the hospital later if you'd like. I'm sure by then I'll be stuck in some dreadful room.
Don't worry, Mrs. Sharp. We'll mail your letter. Want us to bring you books or anything?
Petra asked.
No, no. Oh, the pain of this darn leg. Stupid, stupid.
Mrs. Sharp collapsed back on the stretcher.
All set, ma'am?
One of the EMTs asked her politely.
Well, yes. Does it look like we're sunbathing on the Riviera here?
Mrs. Sharp's voice trailed off into the freezing air as she was loaded into the ambulance. They watched it drive away.
Poor thing. I guess we won't be having tea with her anytime soon, Petra said. I wonder who this letter is for.
Calder reached into his backpack and pulled it out. It was addressed, in neat handwriting, to Ms. Isabel Hussey. They held the letter up to a bright light in school. The envelope was impossible to see through. Giving it directly to Ms. Hussey was tempting, but they had made a promise to Mrs. Sharp. It was hard to know who to be loyal to, or what the consequences of either decision might be. After school, they crunched through the snow to the post office on campus.
Maybe we could steam it open, Calder suggested. Maybe she's just sympathizing. Maybe we're just suspicious, Petra said. Hey, what if we rip open the envelope and then put the letter in a fresh one? We'll just rewrite the address.
In their excitement, they stopped and gave each other a high five. Petra suddenly looked unhappy.
But aren't we getting pretty two-faced here? We go there for tea, we act like nice kids, and then we betray her. How would we like it if someone we trusted read our mail? This is probably how people turn into criminals. They just do something a little bit wrong, and then something a little bit worse.
It's not like we won't mail it afterward. We're keeping our promise. It's an emergency situation, remember?
We're on a mission to rescue Ms. Hussey, the lady, Mrs. Sharp, and ourselves. We may be endangered, too, now that we've got the third letter.
So this is to protect everyone.
Right. We're just doing a little much-needed detective work.
They were now inside, standing next to one of the slits in the wall that read, Stamped Mail.
We could buy an envelope and readdress it here.
Calder dug in his pockets for change. Petra still looked worried.
What will Mrs. Sharp do to us if she finds out? And what if Ms. Hussey recognizes our handwriting? This is foolproof. We're going to put the letter in the mail the minute we've read it. Mrs. Sharp will never know, and I'm sure Ms. Hussey will throw away the envelope.
Just then, someone jostled Calder's arm, and the letter fell. Calder reached for it, and his backpack swung off his shoulder, knocking both him and Petra sideways. The letter was now under a man's leather boot.
Ach, so sorry. This is going in the mail too?
The man then swooped the letter up in a large red paw and stuffed it into the slit along with his mail.
I don't believe it, hissed Calder.
Petra gave Calder a weak smile.
I guess we've been saved from a life of crime.
When they arrived at the hospital, Mrs. Sharp was lying flat in bed. One leg was heavily bandaged.
I can't give you tea, but you can have these. They're all I could get hold of.
Mrs. Sharp handed them each a large chocolate lollipop and pushed some buttons that made the head of her bed go up.
I wanted to thank you for mailing my letter.
The three of them sat for a moment in silence.
I suppose you're wondering what that letter was about.
Calder looked down at his lollipop. Petra swallowed loudly. Mrs. Sharp's eyes narrowed.
Children, was that letter mailed? There is something you're not telling me.
Calder decided to come clean.
Well, you see, we noticed the letter was to Ms. Hussey, And she's our teacher, you know. And we've been following the thief's letters and advertisements in the Chicago Tribune. And we're working together on trying to find the lady. And Petra had a dream about the lady. And so we wanted to read the letter. We were just curious to see if you were worried about Miss Hussey, too.
Stop. Did you open my letter?
Mrs. Sharp's voice was frightening.
No, Petra whispered. It was my fault, too. We thought that because you're smart and you like Vermeer, you might know something about the theft and that you might have some good ideas. We were curious about why you wrote to Miss Hussey. We were going to read your letter and then put it in a new envelope and mail it for you, but we didn't end up opening it. That's the truth. I'm really sorry, Mrs. Sharp. I don't know what got into us.
Petra was almost in tears. There was a long, unbearable silence. Neither Calder nor Petra dared look up. Then a strange creaking sound came from the bed. Mrs. Sharp was laughing. It sounded as though she was a little out of practice. The children looked at her in amazement.
You're not angry? Calder asked.
Oh, not really.
Mrs. Sharp was drying her eyes with a tissue.
I see myself in the two of you. I've done many things in my life out of curiosity, and have regretted very few of them. The important thing here is that you stopped yourselves before you did something wrong.
Her face straightened.
Very wrong. The point is that you must never read someone else's correspondence.
After allowing the children to feel uncomfortable for another few moments, she continued in a brusque tone.
My maiden name, Coffin, is from Nantucket Island, in Massachusetts, and when I read in the papers that Ms. Hussey was from there, I just thought I'd share the coincidence with her. Now, what is this about a dream?
Grateful that Mrs. Sharp didn't seem to be too furious about the letter, Petra started talking. She described in detail her dream about the painting, confiding that no one but Calder knew about it. She mentioned that Vermeer's lady sometimes seemed to communicate with her. Mrs. Sharp studied Petra intensely as she spoke. The old woman's eyes narrowed until they were almost slits in her face.
Yes, she's speaking to you.
Excuse me?
Petra's voice was almost a whisper.
Well, there are many things about life, many experiences, that we don't have an explanation for, as Mr. Fort said. But what interests me is the idea that much of what we humans take to be a lie is true, and much of what we think is true is a lie.
Mrs. Sharp was speaking slowly, looking at her hands.
Charles Fort would have said something to you like, "Who's to say that art isn't alive anyway? Who's to say what's real? If frogs can fall from the sky, why can't paintings communicate?"
Calder had hopped up from his chair.
Petra, remember the Picasso quote that Miss Hussey told us about art being a lie that tells us the truth?
Sit down, boy. You're making my leg nervous.
Mrs. Sharp's frigid tone sent Calder back to his seat. Her face settled into an unreadable expression.
Truth. Perhaps. You think you two could succeed where the FBI has failed?
Well, nothing happens in life unless you try. And we're pretty smart kids, you know.
Calder had pulled out his pentominoes and was quietly making rectangles on the table next to Mrs. Sharp's bed.
We haven't even told you about these.
Smart. You think so?
Mrs. Sharp watched Calder for a moment in silence.
What are those, boy? Some kind of new toy?
They're pentominoes, Calder responded with dignity.
He told Mrs. Sharp the letter name for each of the 12 pieces. Then he explained that you could make many, many rectangles out of them, but that it took practice.
Push that table over here.
Mrs. Sharp tried putting the pieces together for a few minutes, mumbling,
12 pieces,
under her breath again and again. Everyone was quiet. No rectangles appeared.
It's hard at first. It takes time, said Calder kindly.
Pah! Mrs. Sharp was looking frustrated.
I can think of something else you could do with these.
How many, five-letter words, say, could you make using at least 3 of these 12 letters in each word?
Ever done that?
No. Both children were leaning toward the table now. Mrs. Sharp was saying,
Let's see. The letters are F, I, L, N, P, T, U, V, W, or M, X, Y, and Z. I love word challenges like these. Fines, flute, lines, filmy, tails.
Hey, that's 13 letters. Who said the W could be an M? Asked Calder.
I did.
Mrs. Sharp was busily pushing around the pieces.
Wilts and tilts, added Petra.
Melts, shouted Calder. Lower your voice, boy. We don't want one of those policemen outside the door to start bothering us. Now, if you could add another letter, you could have monkey, and then there's panel and vines.
Mrs. Sharp was looking very pleased with herself, muttering,
Fines. Fruit.
At that moment, a nurse bustled into the room.
Time for your medication, Mrs. Sharp.
Oh, go away, she snapped.
The nurse refused, and Calder and Petra stood up to go. As Calder picked up his pentominoes, Mrs. Sharp nodded at them.
Wonderful tools. Could be put to many uses.
Yes, I even like to,
began Calder eagerly. But Petra was pulling on his arm.
We've got to go, Calder.
Mrs. Sharp thanked them for visiting and waved one hand in dismissal. As they walked away, they could hear her arguing with the nurse. That night, Calder got a phone call from Tommy with the terrific news that he and his mom were moving back to Hyde Park. Tommy didn't know exactly when this would happen, but he said that the Dewey Avenue Rescue Fund, the money Calder and Petra had collected by selling brownies, was a definite help. Old Fred hadn't left much behind. Then Tommy told Calder more news. Frog had been found. His parents had gone on a long trip and left him in Washington, D.C. with a relative. No one in Tommy's New York neighborhood had been willing to tell the new kid, in Tommy's words, what was going on. Either that, or they were all so unfriendly that they didn't know or care where Frog and his family were. Tommy said he'd just gotten a postcard from the National Gallery of Art.
One of those Vermeer pictures, the stolen one,
from Frog. Calder couldn't wait to tell Tommy what was going on, but knew he and Petra had to keep quiet for the moment. He called Petra immediately. She was thrilled to hear about Tommy. Calder went on.
Remember the N for National Gallery? That day we were trying to get the pentominoes to say something about where Frog was? That day with the frog napkins and the rain?
Uh-huh. Calder filled Petra in on the rest of the story.
Makes me think of a Charles Fort thing. Frog disappears to the National Gallery. Then a picture of the lady travels back to Tommy. It's not teleportation, but some kind of strange symmetry.
Calder was quiet for a moment.
Or some kind of weird joke, Petra finished. Things going together that don't seem like they should.
Things with a scary sense of humor, added Calder.
Chapter 19, The Shock on the Stairs. After their visit with Mrs. Sharp and the news about Frog, Petra and Calder couldn't wait to get back to the search. The only remaining part of the university school compound that had paneling was King Hall. The middle school and the high school buildings were too new, and Poppyfield Hall had been carved up into studio and theater spaces. Used only for college classes and offices, King Hall was practically empty after school. Starting on the first floor, Petra and Calder worked their way upstairs. there seemed to be miles of dark wood. Leaving the lights out, they ran their hands along square wall panels in lecture rooms, tapping softly and looking for hidden compartments. They opened closets and cupboards, but all were empty. They leaned on grates and rattled bulletin boards. The building seemed discouragingly solid.
"This place is dead compared with Delia Dell," Calder said, looking out at the bright building across the street.
Completed in 1916, Delia Dell Hall boasted countless gargoyles and faces half hidden in decades of ivy. There were stone turrets, an assortment of chimneys, and casement windows. In addition to the original rooms, it had a pool, a pub, and a modern movie theater. Parties and performances were held there. The building cast a warm yellow glow on the snow, a glow that sent fingers of light into the dark classrooms of King.
"So much for my U for the U School Pentomino idea," Petra said, standing next to Calder at the window. "Guess she's not here. How about a quick look in Delia Dell before we go home?"
"Sure. Plus, we can get M&Ms there, and I'm starving."
Their voices faded into the early darkness as they headed across the street, leaving the quiet of King Hall to resettle behind them. Calder and Petra sat on a long bench on the first floor in Delia Dell, sharing blue ones and a bag of potato chips. Snow was falling, magically softening and erasing the university world beneath it. They piled jackets and hats and gloves into a damp mound beside them. Several college students on the other side of the room were talking about a Latin class. A man with heavy eyebrows sat reading a newspaper. A professor, with a head like a pink bowling ball, hurried in the direction of the pool, towel under his arm. A woman carrying a giant ring of keys passed their bench and headed up the stairs. Calder could hear the sharp click of a door opening and the thunk of a lock sliding into place from inside. Petra didn't seem to notice any of this. She was eating steadily, looking straight ahead of her with a sleepy expression. Calder was feeling talkative.
"Wow, this whole place is wood. Look at that staircase. I've never really noticed it before. It looks like something from an old movie. You know, like Betty Davis should be standing at the top."
"Right." Petra stood up and stretched. "Come on, it's getting late."
Away from the entrance hall, they wandered through room after empty room of paneled wood, stone fireplaces, tiled floors. They stayed in the older parts of the building. Neither had realized how big the original part of Delia Dell Hall was. It twisted and turned gracefully, a rectangular dance with surprises in scale and mood. One moment it was grand, the next cozy. There was a huge ballroom space on the first floor with a Tai Chi class going on in one corner. Across the way was a miniature reception room followed by what looked like a dining room. Plaster grapevines covered the heavy beams overhead, and the walls, paneled in rectangles of varying sizes, were interrupted here and there by almost invisible doors. A small wooden knob and a keyhole were the only indications that something might be up. One door led to an old-fashioned kitchen, one to a back staircase, and three or four others were simply locked. The dining area opened into a sunny library with a generous fireplace. Over the mantel, a wooden scroll read, "Dedicated to the life of women at the University of Chicago." Carved lions and horses flanked the dedication. Petra stood in front of it, admiring the elaborate Gothic letters.
"Cool. I wonder what that means."
"My mom told me this was the first place at the university where women students could hang out. Anyway," Calder said, "let's keep going."
On the second floor, there were some offices and three empty lecture rooms, all with rows of wooden chairs, old oil paintings on the walls, and elaborate leaded glass windows. The third floor had a miniature theater. The walls of the room facing the theater were covered with a parade of young people in medieval costumes, dancing, playing, and talking with one another in an idyllic country setting. The north wall had vaulted windows with French doors that opened onto a roof terrace. Petra and Calder stood, awed, at the entrance to the room. A red velvet curtain covered the stage, and on either side was a small wooden door. Propelled by the same urge, they walked slowly toward the stage. There was no one in sight. Without a word, Calder tried the door on the right-hand side. It opened. Three short steps led up to a tiny backstage area. They crept inside, stepping over frayed curtain ropes, a lute with no strings, a plastic pitcher, and an old broom.
"These look like props for a goofy Vermeer," Calder said.
He thought Petra would smile, but she didn't seem to be listening. "Not much place to hide," was all she said. Petra suddenly felt as though she had forgotten something important, or as if she was supposed to be someplace, but couldn't quite remember where. Or maybe it was that she didn't feel well. It was an effort to talk. Back on the second floor, she wandered over to a window seat and sat down. Being next to the casement window felt oddly comforting. Calder was down on all fours looking up into the fireplace.
"I'm just checking for hidden shelves. This building could be filled with secrets we haven't even imagined, you know?"
Hearing no response, he peered around at her.
"What's the matter? You look like you're half asleep."
"Calder, these windows."
Calder sat up.
"Yeah," he said slowly. "Kind of like Vermeer windows."
Petra looked around the room.
"And the paneled wood. I mean, millions of old buildings have paneled wood, but these rectangles..."
Petra's voice trailed off as she stared at her reflection in the darkening glass. Calder came over and sat down quietly next to her.
"Do you want to look around some more?" he asked, sounding like his parents when they were trying to get him to do something but didn't want to be too obvious.
Petra looked steadily at him.
"Calder, what are you thinking?"
"That you sound like we might be getting warm."
Petra was suddenly feeling horribly warm.
"I might just be getting sick. Come on, let's get out of here."
They headed back to the first floor. They passed the weasels that became brass door handles, the carved flute player overhead, the stone lions mounted high above the landing. Petra, resting her hand on the railing as they walked slowly down the sweeping staircase, stopped with a jolt. Calder kept going. The railings were a delicate tangle of iron grapevines and creatures. There were birds, mice, and lizards. Instead of newel posts at the bottom of the staircase, an intricately carved oak monkey clung to either end of the railing. Monkey, panel, vines, flute, fines. She could feel the blood beating wildly in her temples. Monkey, vines, monkey, vines, panel, flute, fines. Fines! Mrs. Sharp's words. Petra stood frozen, one hand gripping the railing. She saw Calder pawing obliviously through their soggy clothing for his jacket. She hoped her face wasn't revealing her wild, screaming thoughts. Walk, just walk normally. A man looked up at her as she passed, putting down his paper. Was the world able to feel her heart pounding, her thoughts on fire? She grabbed her things and burst out the door into the merciful dusk.
"Petra, what's up?"
"Come on."
Calder could hardly keep up with his friend as she half ran, half stumbled through the new snow. She hurried a block east on 59th Street and glanced back. Calder looked back too, suddenly frightened.
"Let's go home through backyards. We need to disappear, okay?"
Calder walked quickly next to Petra, their shoulders touching. He thought of the P for prey. Or was it prey? The blue shadows of late afternoon were menacing now. Bushes between houses seemed filled with pools of darkness, and people, hunched against the cold, looked dangerous. When she was satisfied that they weren't being followed, Petra stopped.
"Calder, this is it."
He looked around at the deserted alleyway and shivered.
This is what?
I think we've found her.
Chapter 20. A Maniac. As Petra brushed her teeth that night, she went over what had happened in Delia Dell Hall. There had been a clear zap in her mind. It reminded her of the time she'd been plugging a frayed lamp cord into the wall, and her finger had landed on bare wire. Had Mrs. Sharp let something slip? Was she hoping they'd pick up on her clues? Petra thought of what Ms. Hussey had once said about criminals wanting to be discovered. If Mrs. Sharp and Ms. Hussey had been collaborating. And then, as if someone had changed the prescription on her glasses, she suddenly saw how wild her ideas had gotten. Were she and Calder crazy to think those two women could be mixed up in the theft? Their suspicions about their neighbor and their teacher suddenly seemed overwrought and childish. How could this staircase experience be anything but a huge, strange coincidence? First of all, she and Calder and Mrs. Sharp had been playing a game with pentominoes. Mrs. Sharp, obviously, had never seen a pentomino before. The words she had made up that afternoon were not something she had planned. Second, she was an old lady. She was the widow of a murder victim. She had gotten a letter from the thief. After weeks of worrying, she had turned it in. She had asked for police protection. And Ms. Hussey was a young teacher and a dedicated one. Why would she ever get mixed up in a major art theft? Petra tapped her toothbrush on the sink in a businesslike way. Her imagination had run away with her in Delia Dell. Hoping to get the mystery solved, she had jumped to some ridiculous conclusions. All this looking was making her crazy. The zap was probably from not feeling well. And Mrs. Sharp's pentomino words were nothing more than a magnificent Charles Fort incident. The stolen painting was probably in Switzerland or Brazil or Japan. She'd apologize to Calder in the morning for scaring him. In 2 days, it would be her 12th birthday. 12-year-olds were old enough to sort out what made sense and what didn't. Petra put down her toothbrush and, sitting on the edge of the bathtub, waited for the water to get hot. She suddenly thought about the lady.
Am I thinking clearly? She wanted to ask her. Did I just imagine what happened today? Are you in Delia Dell?
She waited for a response. There wasn't one. Doubt seeped back into her mind. Since when had she been so rational? Imagining, that was what she was best at. And hadn't she and Calder agreed that they needed to rescue Miss Hussey? And how about that letter she had just found in Mrs. Sharp's bushes? She hopped into the tub and put a hot washcloth on her head. Letting her neck flop backward, she closed her eyes. Suddenly, she found herself picturing a rectangle inside a triangle. It was more a feeling than an image. She dunked her head, letting the water run into her ears. Couldn't she stop thinking? It was a sparkling, whiter-than-white winter morning, a morning of brusque sky, inky black branches, and the blinding, two-dimensional look of new snow. Glancing out her window as she dressed, Petra thought that the branches could be rivers on a map. Or cracks on a blue plate. Maybe there were symbols in an unknown code. How do we know trees don't talk deliberately with their branches, giving slow, intricate messages with an unnoticed vocabulary of shapes? Calder's thinking was infectious. Whistling happily, Petra flew down the stairs to breakfast. The world felt rich with possibility. Her practical reasoning last night now seemed cowardly, unimaginative. What had gotten into her? She thought of the thief's phrase, "I congratulate you all on your pursuit of the truth." It was Saturday morning, and her parents, still in pajamas, their heads almost touching, were absorbed in an article in the Chicago Tribune. They looked upset.
The guy is a maniac, a self-absorbed lunatic.
Petra's father slammed his hand against the table. All the cereal bowls jumped.
What's wrong?
Petra froze.
More news on the Vermeer painting. We'll all have to pray that the FBI knows what they're doing.
Frank Andalese stood up as he spoke, putting a hand on his daughter's shoulder.
Aren't you glad you aren't responsible for saving one of the world's masterpieces from a maniac?
Yeah, Dad.
Her heart sinking, she began to read. The National Gallery of Art received the following anonymous letter yesterday. The last communication from the thief, an advertisement sent to the Chicago Tribune, had been mailed from Florence, Italy. The letter received yesterday was mailed from a post office in Washington, D.C. Both the FBI and the National Gallery of Art felt it was important that the public know immediately about the thief's latest intentions. Dear National Gallery, the recently released book, The Vermeer Dilemma, What Happens Now, points to the public's overwhelming response to my letter and the three advertisements I took out in newspapers around the world. They have, indeed, come to agree with me. Now it is up to you and to your colleagues to agree, publicly, with us all. I demand that you write letters to all other owners of Vermeer paintings. You are to state that my point of view is a valid one, and to request that the attributions that I identified earlier be changed immediately. If these attributions are not changed within 1 month, by January 11th, I will, against my desires, destroy a lady writing. I will consider it a sacrifice in the interest of truth, a lesson for those too rigid, too dishonest, to do what is right. I am old and will not live long. I will, however, live to see this resolved on museum walls and in writing, or, to the horror of us all, in ashes. I beg of you to spare a lady writing. If you look into your hearts, I know that you will, as I predicted in November, come to agree with me. Do what is right. Petra dropped the paper and rushed out of the kitchen. Chapter 21, Looking and Seeing.
This thief is way more ruthless than we thought.
It was 9 a.m., and Calder and Petra were sitting in Calder's kitchen, drinking hot chocolate. His parents were out grocery shopping.
I'll bet if we called the police, Delia Dell would be searched today. And if the painting is there, they'd have a better chance of finding it than we would. The other thing we can do is tell our parents and leave it up to them.
Petra didn't sound particularly happy about either idea. Calder, absorbed in his own thoughts, grinned.
We can also tell no one. I can see the headlines now. Kids locate missing Vermeer. Or, kids brilliantly track down Vermeer masterpiece. Or, kids lead discouraged FBI agents to...
Calder, come on! How can you even think about fame? What would be best for the lady?
Petra closed her mouth in a tight, big sister kind of line.
To be found.
Calder folded his arms across his chest and looked sulky.
You'd like to be on the news, too.
Petra paused to think about seeing herself on a talk show or having her picture on the front of the Chicago Tribune.
Maybe, she said in a kinder voice. I vote we try to find it ourselves today, and if we don't, we talk to our parents and the police tonight.
Fine. I think we should call Mrs. Sharp first.
Why?
Calder had pulled the eye pentomino out of his pocket and was flipping it back and forth on the table.
Because the letter sounds like her talking? We know it's not. She's in the hospital, and besides, she would never harm a Vermeer.
She might help us.
Petra gave her mug a decisive tap with her spoon.
We'll tell her what happened in Delia Dell. That will make her curious. Then, if she knows something, maybe she'll just blurt it out.
Both were looking at the eye.
What's it saying?
Petra asked.
Instant, Calder said. Guess that means get going.
They called the hospital and asked for Mrs. Sharp's room. When she answered, Petra said,
Calder and I were spending some time in Delia Dell yesterday.
And?
Mrs. Sharp's voice could have cut steel.
The letter in the paper. We're worried.
There was silence on the other end.
Mrs. Sharp, we just didn't want you to worry about us.
Don't flatter yourselves. Why should I worry?
Before Petra could tell her about the zap on the staircase, the old woman said,
Just be careful. Looking and seeing are two very different things.
The phone line went dead. Calder left his parents a note. He and Petra put on their coats and headed for the campus. They hurried in through the side door of Delia Dell, and Petra skidded on the wet floor tiles. Her feet went out from under her, and she came to a painful stop in front of one of the benches. Scrambling to her knees, she looked up into a man's face. He had eyebrows so thick that they hung precariously over his eyes, which seemed far too small for the size of his face.
Slippery stuff, is it not?
The man's voice was low and pleasant. He had a foreign accent.
These old floors are terrible when they are wet, but it's a wonderful building, very wonderful.
He smiled at Petra, his eyes almost vanishing beneath the outcroppings of hair. He offered her a large hand.
You two were visiting the other day, no?
Something about this man was familiar. Petra was on her feet.
I'm fine,
she blurted, and shoved Calder back out the door in front of her.
Great, that man noticed us, and you acted all nervous. Now what do we do? What was I supposed to say? Which way to the Vermeer? Did you recognize that voice? I think it was the man from the post office.
What man? Calder asked.
The guy who stepped on Mrs. Sharp's letter.
Well, whoever he is, we could have just kept going. If we didn't stick out before, we sure do now.
This was the closest they had come to a fight. Petra's elbows were sore, and she was mad at herself. She knew Calder was right. After all, the man might be nobody.
Wait, Calder said. I have an idea. I think I remember a basement entrance.
They walked quickly around to the east side of the rambling building. There, miraculously, was a small open door half a flight up behind a walled area. The door was propped open with a dented trash can.
Wow, if anyone asks us what we're doing, we'll explain that we're making a plan of the building for school.
Calder didn't sound as confident as he was trying to feel.
Let's get out paper and pencils so it looks like we're really working on something, added Petra.
Armed with materials, they crept closer. It was hard to see into the darkened doorway. They paused outside, listening, then peered around the corner. There was no one in sight. They tiptoed down a long corridor that curved to the left and then to the right. Swinging doors opened into a room with a single light bulb overhead. Once inside, they were faced with three possible exits. They picked the one in the middle.
Ew!
Calder stepped over a nasty pile of garbage that smelled of sour milk and sneakers. Petra kept her mitten over her nose. They were soon in a maze of small passageways.
What direction do you suppose we're going in?
Calder asked, looking around at the peeling paint.
No idea, but I want it to be up, Petra said.
They found themselves at a fork. To their relief, one direction led to an iron stairwell. They hurried toward it. On the second floor, a diamond-shaped window looked into a hall.
I can't see much. You try.
Calder stepped aside. At that moment, a blue sweater flashed by. Both kids ducked, and Petra hit Calder in the nose with her hair clip.
Petra, watch what you're doing, will you?
Calder forgot to whisper, and the sweater reappeared, pausing for several long seconds on the other side of the door before going on.
Calder, that looked just like my dad's sweater. I've got to peek out. What'll we say if it is him? He'll ask what we're doing here.
I don't know, but I need to see if that's my dad.
They went as quietly as they could down the hall past several offices. When they reached the corner, they saw the man in the blue sweater walking up the stairs to the third floor, carrying a smallish rectangular package. The man was definitely Frank Andely.
Weird, Petra whispered. What would he be doing here? He sometimes works Saturdays, but on the other side of campus.
Petra was remembering her dad's anger that morning and the way he had pounded the table. She also remembered his words.
Aren't you glad you aren't responsible for saving one of the world's masterpieces from a maniac?
The word maniac echoed in a frightening way in her mind. Did he feel that he was responsible? Maybe he had stumbled onto something he shouldn't have, and that was what had made him so grumpy lately. She remembered him muttering the words, alone, or had it been alone? Either one was spooky. And then there was the talk about two mysterious letters, and also what she'd overheard him saying that fall to her mom.
Everyone has something to hide.
Seeing how miserable Petra looked, Calder patted her on the back.
I'm sure he has a good reason for being here.
Stashing backpacks and jackets in a window seat, they began exploring the second floor of Delia Dell. During the next half hour, they tapped, they studied, they pressed, they poked, they leaned, they tugged, they opened, they closed. Several closets appeared, walls creaked, but there was no sign of the painting.
Petra couldn't concentrate. I just can't imagine what business he'd have in Delia Dell, she said.
He'd be wondering the same thing if he saw you.
And that package he was carrying was just the right size.
Petra suddenly felt very tired of suspecting people. First Mrs. Sharp, then Ms. Hussey, then both of them, and now her dad? Calder seemed to pick up on her thoughts.
Sneaking around and trying to figure people out isn't as much fun as I thought it would be, he said.
Looking through one of the windows, she saw her dad and the man from the post office cross the parking lot.
Calder, they're together.
Petra noticed that her dad's shoulders were hunched and his hands were stuffed in his pockets. He was no longer carrying the package. Chapter 22, Twelves. By the time Calder and Petra stepped outside, both men were gone. There were no footsteps to follow. The snow was packed into an unreadable mass.
Guess we should go, Petra said.
Yup.
On the way back to Harper Avenue, Calder and Petra made a plan. They would return to Delia Dell that night. Each would tell their parents that they were over at the other's house.
I guess we may be headed for a life of crime after all.
Petra gave Calder a half-hearted grin.
But this is different. It'll be an early birthday adventure. I mean...
She stopped short. Now Calder looked uncomfortable.
How did you know?
How did I know what?
My birthday.
What? It's my birthday too.
To Petra's surprise, Calder seemed more preoccupied than anything else. He was looking at the T pentomino in his right hand.
T for 12. We're both 12 on 12-12.
Why didn't I see this before?
Wow, was all Petra said. He went on.
It's a puzzle that hinges on 12s. There are the pentominoes, of course, and the fact that we're both turning 12 on the 12th day of the 12th month. And I'll bet there's more about the painting or about Vermeer that works with 12s. Calder, you're either totally nuts or absolutely brilliant. Maybe both.
And we have just about 12 hours to figure this out. Think we can do it?
I do.
That evening, the kids were crouched behind a bush just under the first floor windows of Delia Dell. It was 10 minutes to 7. The blue sky and white snow of the morning had deepened into an icy purple laced with black.
"It's the post office man," whispered Calder.